Welcome to My PT Podcast, the podcast dedicated to providing encouragement and insight to the rehab community. I'm your host, Devin DeVore, and today I'm joined by Trisha Hoffman. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely.
This isn't my first time visiting with Trisha. I used to work for her a couple different times. So thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Today's topic is to talk about PDGM. there's a lot of P's in there. I just got done talking with somebody about PDPM, but we're going to dive into the home care changes that are occurring. And Trisha, I just wanted to, it's starting January 1st,
correct.
2020.
Yep.
And what are your thoughts on just general first blush overview of the changes upcoming?
Well, the first blush overview, you know, there's a lot of different directions to take it. First of all, I'm kind of glad they're getting away from the therapy thresholds. I'll be honest about that.
As a rehab manager.
As a rehab manager, yes. I do think that our current model can force some bad behaviors on some agencies.
Okay.
They really probably pay a little bit too much attention about how many therapy visits they're doing. And not everyone. I don't want to say everyone's a bad player, but this is part of the reason why PDGM, I think, came about, where it takes those therapy thresholds away. Therapy is no longer driving, and we're really looking at quality. And also we're looking at, you know, diagnoses and weighting those a little bit differently now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good thing. Some concerns, of course, that we have with PDGM coming out is that they're looking at reducing payments based on behavioral assumptions, which could backfire.
What do you mean by behavioral assumptions?
Behavioral assumptions. So CMS is thinking that because we're changing to a new model that is putting a little bit more emphasis on clinical groupings, clinical documentation, that people are going to change their behaviors and they're going to have primary diagnoses that pay more.
Okay.
And they're going to find secondary diagnoses that support it and pay more. So the way that they're doing the groupings and your case mix is going to change. So CMS thinks, okay, people are going to be changing some of their behaviors, so we are going to potentially reduce payments by 8.01% is what they're looking at right now.
8% reduction?
Yes, they're looking at a possible 8% reduction, but at the same time, they're looking to increase payments by 1.3% overall. So I'm not sure how that works, but right now, there has been some legislation introduced to possibly not create those behavioral assumptions, because we're looking at, from our agency and from our perspective, okay, so you're saying we're going to do these things and you're reducing us 8%, so now you've incentivized people to absolutely find the diagnoses that are going to pay the most. So, you know, it's almost, I feel like it's almost a backfire in a way if they automatically do enter these behavioral assumptions.
But where are these diagnoses coming from? Aren't they coming from the hospital or the primary physician, wherever they're entering from, the community or?
They are, and this is where the challenge also lies, I think, as far as from a home health agency.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we have a lot of codes, ICD-10 codes, that come in, and they're really not primary diagnoses that we're getting. We're getting diagnoses like generalized weakness from physicians.
Mm-hmm.
That's often what people are coming in, and that's not going to fly under PDGM. You can't have a primary diagnosis of generalized weakness. The primary diagnosis needs to be what's causing the generalized weakness.
Okay. CHF or the COPD.
Exactly.
Or respiratory
and
failure,
so that's not always in the physician's documentation. So we are struggling right now to get that quality documentation from the physician with those diagnoses in it. And it also has to support the need for home care. It can't just be listing the primary diagnosis. There also has to be something in there stating how that impacts them and their need for home health care.
Because there's, how many different groupings are there? Is there 12?
Yeah, there's 12 different clinical groupings. Yep. Yeah. So They need to fall under one of those clinical groupings.
And what are those 12? Just
sure. I actually have them here. We have musculoskeletal rehab, neural stroke rehab, wounds, behavioral health care, complex nursing interventions. And then there's a big group of the medication management teaching and assessment, which involves surgical, endocrine, GI, infectious diseases, respiratory.
And none of those exclude therapy.
Correct. None of those exclude therapy, but because of the changes, there are some pretty common diagnoses that are currently being used that will not be able to be used. So,
such as
the generalized weakness, as some of those that really are more symptom diagnoses.
Okay.
They're not so much primary diagnoses.
Okay.
So, our intake department and anybody's intake department is going to have to be extremely vigilant and looking at the paperwork coming in.
The coding, you mean?
Yes. Well, what can be coded.
When we
get a referral from a physician or the hospital, especially from a physician's office,
right,
we need to make sure that note that we're getting covers, gives us a primary diagnosis that's usable and also gives a reason for the need for home care.
Gotcha.
So intake plays a vital role in PDGM. Not that they haven't played a vital role before,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they play a much more vital role because now there's danger of rejection for a lot of these things that were kind of sliding by the system before.
So you guys, as an institution, trying to educate your intake and your referring family physicians
absolutely
about what you really need?
Absolutely, yes. So currently, we are looking over notes that we're getting from physicians and discharge notes and making sure that they contain the contents that they need.
Okay.
If they don't, we are contacting physicians,
already?
yes, just to in
oh,
preparation
wow.
because we need, this needs to be up
have
and ready and going. Exactly,
yeah,
before
no
January.
Grace period, right?
Exactly.
It's just, boom, it starts. Okay.
Yep, so we definitely have, that screening going on so that we're aware of, where we're getting referrals from that may need some work and just some education to physicians on what we need, what contents are needed to justify home health care.
Have your projections seen that like 80% of the referrals do have the contained information you need to put them in a grouping?
Yeah. What we've seen so far, actually our biggest weakness is probably that.
Oh, okay.
Is what's being coded as primary diagnosis.
Okay.
So when they've done analysis, that's mm-hmm. been the biggest, and that's been our focus,
mm-hmm.
is really making sure that we're getting not a symptom diagnosis, but a primary diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be the most difficult, but it is getting better, I would say.
Okay.
And a lot of times intake will come to me and run by. Is this a therapy diagnosis or is this more a symptom? So
let's just take your typical. Let's say a grandfather has congestive heart failure. He goes in the hospital because he has an increased fluid on board.
Mm-hmm.
They give him some diuretics. He's there 3 days. He's home, but he can't make it up the stairs, doesn't have the endurance to get around the house, was not using a walker, now is using a walker at the hospital. What does that look like from a PDGM standpoint?
A case like that should be okay from a PDGM standpoint. For the fact that we would have probably a primary of CHF.
Yep.
And, depending on, again, what was written in the note and how it was written, functional level definitely went from independent ambulator to potentially using
stairs.
A walker, having
yeah.
difficulty with stairs, So I think, as long as the note, it depends on how it was written. If he came home and he had home care orders from the hospital, that would be good.
Mm.
If he didn't, he would want to go through his primary physician in that case.
Okay.
But we could still get the notes
mm-hmm.
from the hospital. And that's, I guess, the nice thing with our system too, is that we're
you're
connected
part of the
with,
system.
Yeah, with Epic. If you have Epic, you're connected with the
right.
system. So, but, yeah, so I think, the straight cut diagnoses are a little bit easier. We, if you have somebody with CHF. The difficult ones lie when maybe somebody does present to the hospital with generalized weakness and there's multiple comorbidities that may be leading to it, but we're not exactly sure. And then it's a matter of really nailing down what's causing this and how do we code that. I think sometimes
does it have to be a new or an exacerbation of an old diagnosis, either one? So it can't be like a, like, for example, a lot of times people like with neurological problems where mm-hmm. they do have a cardiac issue or an infection, their neurological symptoms that were old are now worse,
right?
You know, so does it have to be a new diagnosis as well?
It doesn't necessarily have to be a new. It could be an exacerbation. It depends on how it's written. It really depends on how it presents, you know, either to the physician or in the hospital, and how it's presented back to us, you know, as far as if it's going to be okay to clear for home care. But yeah, it's so that's where documentation becomes vital. You know, our documentation is important in supporting it, whatever primary diagnosis we have. Mm-hmm. But the documentation we receive from discharges or physician notes is just as important. Mm. And so that's the part that's a little scary because we have a lot less control over over that sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and then it's a 30-day window that you that captures it, correct? So
correct.
That you get based on the grouping you're in and the comorbidity
correct.
Level.
So there's for case mixes, there's five things that are going to affect it. The timing of it, which is early or late. Early episodes are now those first 30 days. And after 30 days now is no longer an early episode. It used to be the whole 60-day
right?
period would be considered early. Now, the nice thing is you're not going to have to redo an OASIS in 30 days. Thank goodness.
Oh, thank goodness.
So that's that. The OASIS schedule still remains the same unless there's a significant change in condition, and then you could do a significant change OASIS. However, in general, the OASIS schedule isn't changing. So there's early, late timing. There's the admission source, which is institutional or community. That's also interesting, too, though, because institutional is 14 days prior to admission. So if within the last 14 days, if you were in a skilled nursing facility, hospital, inpatient rehab facility, patient psych hospital, or long-term care hospital, that would be considered institutional. Anything else is community. Now, the interesting part on top of that is, okay, so let's say you're in your first 30-day period, and you came from a skilled nursing facility, so you were considered institutional when we first admitted you. Let's say it's just not working out, and you end up having to go back to a skilled nursing facility. If we pick you up again in that second 30 days, it's no longer considered institutional from a skilled nursing facility. It will only be considered institutional if in the last 14 days of those 30, you were in an inpatient facility. So if you were an inpatient, so any longer, those skilled facilities and things won't be considered institutional, and you'll be considered coming from the community, which is a lower payment.
I was going to wonder, okay, so it is lower payment or more less points, they call that.
Exactly, right? Which will end up, you know, essentially being a lower payment likely from institutional to community. The clinical groupings also play into the case mix. Functional level, which they're going to classify into one of three levels, high, medium, and low. And then there's the M1800 questions that are going to go into that.
I wondered about that. Can you just dive into that a little bit more about how much education you're going to have to do? Because that seems like it's pretty critical. And
yes.
Not that we don't know how to answer those questions, but it seems like it's really important now.
It's very important. So, you know, we did have the M1800s went into functional level with the PPS system. Mm-hmm. However, they've added two. Yes, they've added grooming, M1800 grooming, and M1033 risk of hospitalization. Are two items that have gone into that assessment of functional level.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's crucial. And this is where we do see a lot of variation. So the M1800s address your ADLs, bathing, mm-hmm. transferring, ambulation, all of those things. We sometimes see a difference, though, in how nursing and therapy scores.
Exactly, yes.
So we have done a lot of education with our nursing staff and our therapy staff to really work together on these. And you can collaborate on OASIS now.
Okay.
It's not just based on the nurse's assessment anymore.
Okay.
You can collaborate on these based on what you're seeing within that five-day window. What we have done to, I'll tell you what we have done to address accuracy with answering is we hold weekly meetings with all of our nursing and therapy staff. We go through every single patient, and we make sure that anyone who is admitted, we have this meeting with our staff within 5 days.
That,
you know, we if there's any impact on the OASIS, we can we can do that. So we meet with them. We, you know, find out where their levels are and make sure that things are making sense together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're not scoring somebody, you know, inappropriately high for ambulation but low for transfers or vice versa, you know, that all the answers are making sense together.
Do they break down the transferring? Is it just transferring, or is it sit-to-stand transfers, stand-pivot transfers?
This one is from, the M1850 is going from your bed, sitting up, to the nearest chair.
So that includes walking?
Yes.
Yes.
Because the question is to the nearest chair.
Correct.
Which if they don't have a chair by their bed,
it could be the living room.
It could be the living room.
Right.
So, you know, it may or may not include an assistive device and walking. It, you know, in most cases, I don't know a lot of people that have chairs by their beds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it probably does involve walking.
Yes.
So that's the tricky part for some staff. But we found with doing weekly meetings and really drilling down to make sure that staff are understanding these, we're getting much more consistency with the answers, which is important and is going to be critical going into PDGM too.
So I often had the problem of, until I read that particular part of it, is I would say that they needed assist maybe to sit to stand because maybe they had the weakness, but once they were up walking, they were like a standby assist. Yeah.
Right.
So like, well, how could you have... It's basically assessing the same thing with two different answers. How can I do
it
do that?
Yeah, essentially it could be, depending on where the location is.
Right.
So. And the last thing that's going to affect the case mix is those comorbidities that we were talking about. So in the PPS system, the comorbidities were based on the top six OASIS spots. Now comorbidities are given for select diagnoses in up to 25 spots on the claim. So... And there are 13 different groups of diagnoses that qualify. For the different adjustments. So it's a little bit more complex now, I think, as far as, you know, how they're looking at things. We went from the home health resource groupings. We had 153 under PPS. We now have 432 under PDGM.
So, each with their own individual payment system?
Yes. And you may have heard the LUPAs are changing too, the low utilization payments.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be standard less than 5 was a LUPA. Now, depending on your HERG scores and you know the complexities and everything, it can be anywhere. A LUPA can be anywhere from 2 to 6 visits.
Okay.
So that's where people have to be careful, especially in those second 30 days. Not saying that you want to base care only on LUPAs or anything like that, but just an awareness of, you know, if I go 5 visits in on day 31 through 60, is this going to be a LUPA? You know, not again, just being aware of it.
Right.
It doesn't really change your practice per se, but just is there a different way to organize visits, you know, because that's going to be the challenge going forward with just the 30-day thresholds now as far as, you know, looking at the payment. It's going to be a little bit more challenging on those second 30 days. So.
And then the LUPA, if you do have one, it's it's a per visit rate, correct? Versus the whole month.
Yep.
And this might be a really obvious question, but does a home care agency get the whole lump sum for the 30 days no matter what they provide in that 30 days?
Not really. Yes and no. So right now we have RAPs, the request for anticipated payments.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So those will be eventually going away too.
Okay.
So everything will be pretty much post-payment. So now, you know, based on our OASIS and everything, we present a RAP.
Mm-hmm.
Request for anticipated payment, and we get partial payment.
Like 60%,
right? Yep. And then we get the rest after.
Yep.
But if they do an audit and they end up downcoding or changing things, you know, then of course we have to pay back.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
We have to reimburse based on that. So, you know, yes and no, you get, it depends on if they audit and if they change and if, you know, if you can defend.
Okay.
So
how will an agency then get paid? So you submit what all these things, the admission source, the timing, the clinical, the functional,
yep,
paralegal, the comorbidity.
So you'll still get paid on all of that, and it'll come out with a number and an amount for the month, and then you'll get a set, theoretically you'll get a set amount for that month.
For that patient
based on that score.
Okay.
So yes, that's essentially how you'll get paid. And then, you know, there is auditing of so many charts, and then like I said, if they don't agree with
how you're delivering it
or what you coded, then there could be a take back on that.
Okay.
So, but in general, yes, it'll be based on those five pieces that plan to case mix.
In switching gears a little bit, in SNF, the PDPM, they still have to record the number of visits that they had with PT, OT, and speech.
Right, and minutes.
And minutes.
Yep.
Are you gonna have to capture that as well as number of visits and record that for CMS for them to look at? Because I see how people think. It's like, well, I have this amount of money, and if I can go from averaging 6 therapy visits down to 4.5.
Yep.
I've just saved our company quite a bit of money, and our outcomes are no different.
Right. Well, there is a question on the OASIS regarding exactly that. Asks you to capture all of the visits.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me just a second here.
That's right. No worry, you can
use that. There. There is a question on the OASIS that asks you to capture the number of visits.
Correct. Yep.
So that will still be there. And they are going to look at those behaviors as well.
Yeah.
Just like they are in PDPM.
Yes.
They're looking to see who's going from ultra high to maybe, you know, high or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to look for those same behaviors.
Okay.
And those organizations are likely going to be higher risk for audit.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you have, as an agency, have done your figuring and you've gone to the CMS calculator and you've seen that you're going to lose 20% based on your current therapy utilization, and you change practice drastically, you will likely be up for audit.
That's something you want to happen, that's for sure.
Right.
Wow.
So that, you know, is the danger of overutilization.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of us who found that, hey, we're actually right where we're at, we're not changing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I wouldn't recommend anyone change behavior until we get into the system and live it a little bit anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's any new system, PDPM, PDGM, there's so much that, you know, you can read, you can study, you can look at everything, but until you start living it, you really don't know exactly how it's going to impact you. So there's so many variables.
Speaking of living it and impact, how do you think this is going to impact PT, OT, and speech in general?
In general, I have a feeling that in some agencies it might reduce the number of staff.
Okay. Why? Because they were overutilizing before?
Overutilizing, yeah. Some of the reading I have done have shown that, 30 to 40%, depending on who they tally feel like they're probably overstaffed and might reduce staff at this point. Mm-hmm. So there's that potential danger. Mm-hmm. Although, like I said, you know, I would recommend before anybody start reducing staff, live it first and mm-hmm. really see. Mm-hmm. So there's potential for that. However, like every system change that we've had, there's always kind of a rebalancing, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything starts as a panic.
Yes.
And then we kind of get rebalanced. So mm-hmm. initially we might see a drop off, you know, mm-hmm. possibly some less use of PTOT speech mm-hmm. in general. However, I think we'll find that balance again.
Okay.
I think, you know, there might be knee-jerk reactions from organizations that just say, okay, no, we're way overstaffed or, you know.
Is that same true for nursing?
No. Under PDGM, I would say no.
Okay.
A lot of...
Because they weren't really... Payment wasn't based on them before.
Exactly. Payment wasn't based on them before. And a lot of the reimbursement-heavy diagnoses are nursing-related, too.
Okay.
There's some therapy ones, too, but, you know, mm-hmm. You know, when you're looking at some of the wound care and complex wounds, things like that.
Okay.
There's some pretty good reimbursements. So, again, coding is going to be key, and really making sure that you're capturing accurately the coding.
Prior and for when you're doing your OASIS forms.
When you're doing your OASIS,
you have to capture what the patient actually looks like and presents as.
Exactly, yes. So our coding here and in many organizations is outsourced. So that will be interesting to see too if more companies end up outsourcing or if they bring it in-house. You know, right now we do checks with our coding company that we have. And there's occasional errors. There was one patient that was deaf primary diagnosis for PT treatment was schizophrenia. That's not going to fly, you know? So it's just, you know, you have to be careful.
It's creative.
Yeah, it's creative. You have to kind of keep checks and balances if you are outsourcing on coding as well. I mean, you know, the majority are good but and correct, but there's going to be the occasional checks, too, that you'll want because they're not going to fly as primary diagnoses. Hmm. So, and I'm sure coding companies are getting the education, too, and my guess is that we might see more people going to our coding companies initially.
Just outsourcing that. They want to get the professional or the one that's
somebody who's focused on it.
It's our area of expertise, let them handle it type thing.
Yep. Hmm. So we'll see. We'll see if that shifts a little bit. And again, I think everything will end up rebalancing itself within a few years. But, you know, anytime we have these big changes in reimbursement and any, you know, skilled nursing or home care, there's an initial panic, mm-hmm. I think.
So what are you guys focusing on over the next, we're just in September, so we have 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
What are you focusing on in the next 3 months to prep your staff?
Really just educating them on what the changes are. Making our clinicians aware of the importance of capturing OASIS accurately.
Okay.
And capturing primary diagnosis accurately, too. So we have everything outsourced to, you know, as far as the coding to a company, but it is ultimately our clinician's responsibility as well to make sure that that's captured accurately. So really giving them ownership and educating them on, you know, thinking about what's being coded. Does this make sense? Is this what I'm really treating?
Mm-hmm.
So really being able to make sure that they're able to connect those two. If they're not, we might have an issue. So we want them to be not experts in coding, but experts in the sense of, does this make sense with what I'm treating? And if it doesn't, I need to go to someone and we need to discuss this.
Because my modus operandi before was, just say yes to whatever the coder said. Yes. Get them off my back.
We did that all the time.
It's like, sure, whatever you say.
Sounds good.
Yep. Okay.
But now it becomes important that when we're checking our OASIS and those diagnoses, is that something I'm treating? Is that something that I'm focusing on? Is that the primary reason I'm in here? Do these comorbidities make sense too? Mm-hmm. You know? And so it's really becoming a little bit more aware. Like I said, not becoming a coding expert, but at least being aware enough to know if something doesn't match. Like, am I treating schizophrenia?
No. Might impact my treatment, but
you know, and if I'm not, what's the next, you know, what out of their diagnoses makes sense that I might be treating? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and we may not. We may struggle with that. So we need to be able to go to somebody within our agency who has the expertise to know that. So
because the functional level that they are presenting as and the code, it has to match what they're actually getting coded as and setting goals for.
All has to come together. So it'll be interesting to see how it all comes together as far as, you know, what it really looks like. And all we can do is guesstimate based on calculators and what we're seeing. And, you know, I think every agency has probably done some assessment of where their strengths and weaknesses are.
And you said you did that through CMS. Do they offer like a projector tool?
CMS has a projector tool that you can kind of calculate to see what your reimbursement might look like. Some of the others were within our organization where we look to see where our weaknesses were, like, for instance, knowing the coding piece and making sure that we're coding things that will be appropriate under PDGM. That's how we knew that we needed to work with physicians, our coders, you know, and making sure that we're capturing everything. So it's good to do a little assessment. And it was also, like I said, refreshing in the sense of knowing that we're not overutilizing therapy now.
Yes.
So
kudos to your organization to doing the right. It's really nice that same thing happened with this Matt Williams over at Thornapple Manor. He did the projection tool and they had a bump in their reimbursement too. And it's really nice to see that the people that were being honest before are getting rewarded for their honesty and their ethical care of their patients.
Correct. Really. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. And, you know,
I was listening to an APTA webinar this spring, and ahead of this, knowing that it was going to change for SNFs in October and for home health for you guys in January. And I remember that this descriptor was, the presenter was saying, we're here because it's our own fault. We have overutilized because CMS can gone back and looked, and all this documentation, all this evidence says that whether they come in with, it doesn't matter what their diagnosis was, what their functional level was, we always put them in the highest category, whether it was home health or whatever.
Absolutely.
It was SNF.
With our last system, when they started with the therapy thresholds, therapy utilization was at 10% in home health agencies. It jumped to 39%. So, and I can tell you the same thing happened in skilled nursing facilities with RUGs.
Well, yeah.
You're shooting for ultra high. You want that ultra high. You know, and so.
And who want all of us as therapists? I don't know how many times I was in the room and they're like, you have to get 50 minutes with this person today.
I heard that.
You have
to
educate them, something, do something, work on, you know, whatever. And it just killed. Every therapist, I think, had that soul-killing moment where I'm like, I am doing no value to this person.
Where they wanted you doing 3 hours of a person who was partially comatose. Yes.
I mean, how many quad sets and hamstring sets?
Exactly.
How many rolls to the left can you do?
So, you know, exactly. And so I do think there's great value in the changes in PDGM and PDPM. Mm-hmm. I think CMS has to be careful not to incentivize bad habits with possible behavioral assumptions and those reductions that might instill bad habits. I'm not sure.
Sure. That seems like it'd be easier to catch, though.
Seems like it would be.
Because if you don't have the documentation to have Mrs. Jones have all these diagnoses.
Exactly.
I think that would be hard to recreate.
But so we'll see how everything responds. But I am glad in both skilled nursing and home care that they're getting away from therapy being the driver. It really should be about their diagnosis, the complexity mm-hmm. of their, you know, of their condition, their comorbidities. Mm-hmm. That really should, because that tells you a lot about how much care overall they're going to need from nursing, from therapy, yes. you know, from
ancillaries.
And that jives with
what we've been trained as. We look for the deficits. We try to get optimized. The patients return to their functional level as best they can.
Correct.
Not trying to create something.
We're just... And every patient isn't the same. You know, I've worked at organizations that have tried to set up, you know, well, if they're CHF, they get 3 therapy visits. And if they're, you know, stroke, they should be between 6 to 9 therapy visits. And I'm thinking, you know, you really... It's nice to have a guideline, I suppose, but you have to be really careful in that, because there's so many comorbidities that can impact that, that, you know, okay, they might have CHF, but they also might have diabetes, and they also might have neuropathy with that, and they also might have, you know, all these other things that impact their function.
Short-term memory loss. Now I got to stay in there a little bit longer to make sure they're
family
members.
Dementia's huge. Dementia and short-term memory loss are huge impactors, and they really do. And we have to be vigilant in our documentation to show why we're in as long as we are. I hear that from my therapists a lot. They get nervous if they're in a case too long, because we've been trained, you know, you got to get out. You got to get out. You can't be in there that long, especially if they're not progressing fast enough. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'll get that nervousness from my therapist. Well, you know, Mrs. Jones is you know, she's making progress, but it's slow. And I'm like, well, how are you documenting it, though? That's the difference. How are you documenting that function and how it's progressing? And are you explaining why it's taking longer? If you're doing all those pieces, you're justifying why you're in there. Mm-hmm. So don't feel like there's, you know, there's no magic number for anyone. Mm-hmm. Yep, there's guidelines. You know, we have our APTA guidelines as well. Yep. Mm-hmm. Those are helpful, but those are guidelines. Mm-hmm. And it's really our documentation that paints the picture. And that's exactly what we need to do. And it's not necessarily always natural to therapists. We need to paint the picture. Why are we in here? What are we doing? How does it relate to their diagnoses? How is their function changing? How is it improving? And that's what we have to show.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you so much.
You
I just love your holistic and balanced approach. I think you've really kind of done a nice job of kind of painting the picture of what it's going to be like and how it'll affect people, and I'm sure it's going to be of value to people. So thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. You are welcome.
How can people get a hold of you if they have questions for you? Any contact information?
Easiest way is probably via email. I'm in and out. I'm bouncing in and out of offices, so let me give you that. It's T. Hoffman, which is T-H-O-F-F-M-A-N, the number 1, @lakelandhealth.org.
Okay.
That's probably the easiest way to contact me if you have any questions, and I will try my best to answer.
And thank you again for your wisdom and discernment on this. Appreciate it a lot.
So. Absolutely. Thanks for
your time.
Interviewing.